Welcome, everybody, to a Baseball America podcast, along with J.J. Cooper. I'm John Manuel. J.J. is joining us live from Port Charlotte, Florida, as we start our spring training whip-around, I guess you could say, in at Baseball America this spring. If only we were doing this all in one video feed, J.J., it would be awesome. But we've got
now we go to Arizona, and again to Arizona, and again to Arizona.
Exactly, but now we go to Florida, so we have three jokers in Arizona. Josh Norris already there. Ben Badler and Matt Eddy going over the weekend. Ben for an international tour and international prospects being brought to Arizona. And Matt Eddy for the Sabre Conference. Josh is there just covering spring training like you are. And JJ, you're in Florida. So first off, sorry. Second of all, what's the best part? What's the best part of spring training in Florida, if you had to give one?
The best part is that you... You know the pods, like in Arizona, you know, there are teams that there's a lot more shared complexes and all that. But I do like here that you have these little pods of four teams. And right. So pretty easily in a day, you can see some aspects of four different teams. You know, if you go over, well, or three, you go over to the workouts in the morning and you see one club. And if you really want to and hustle, you can then go to another club during the afternoon and see, you know, two teams facing off, two clubs playing each other. So you do have that kind of going for it. And not going to really help me if coming down to, you know, as a fan, hey, you got the beaches not far away too. I mean, that's the difference between Florida and Arizona.
That's a great point. That's an important distinction.
Didn't even pack a swimsuit, John. I've got 7 days here, and I plan on packing in as much baseball as I can, not as much beach. But
yeah, I guess the other difference is the color green versus the color brown.
Yes.
You know,
there's a lot of green. You know, there's a lot of green here. There's a lot of brown and a lot of gravel in Arizona.
That's for sure. A lot of crushed red brick. So so now you started off in Dunedin, correct? The capital city of Florida. On the West Coast, but you, so you're starting on the West Coast. Who have you seen so far?
So I've seen first day of minor league spring training on Tuesday. Saw Blue Jays and Phillies, both their A ball clubs, and then yesterday I saw Red Sox and Twin, both their A ball clubs, and then today I'm at, as you mentioned, Port Charlotte. I'm at the Rays complex right now. I've watched BP and workouts here in the morning. Now I'm headed to Sarasota to watch Rays and Orioles AA and AAA clubs face each other over at the Orioles complex. And then tomorrow, going over to Bradenton to see Tyler Glasnow pitch and watch Pirates. I can't remember who the Pirates are playing yet. And then, it's got to be the Phillies, the Blue Jays, or the Yankees, though, because that's their little pod. And then this weekend, head over to Kissimmee, see the Astros, and then hopefully get over to Jupiter, see the Cardinals and Marlins, maybe the Braves, and I'll wrap up with a little swing by the Yankees camp for workouts on Tuesday before flying back out.
Well, let's start off then with that Toronto-Philadelphia day, what you kind of saw down there, and I guess those are two, you know, bottom 10 ranked farm systems, at least in the handbook. We'll do another organization talent ranking in our minor league preview issue next, which we're wrapping up part two of our major league preview with the focus on the rookies in this issue of Baseball America. Then we'll have the minor league preview next issue, which a lot of the spring training reporting clearly is geared to. But JJ, when we talk about those two organizations, they're ranked in the bottom 10 for completely different reasons. Toronto, mostly because it traded away all of its talent. Philadelphia, because they just really haven't drafted and developed much talent as much recently, but they're both organizations that take a lot of risks, that are high risk, high reward draft philosophies. Was that evident when you saw their clubs and the one day look that you had?
Oh yeah, I would say with the Blue Jays, they're probably a bottom third organization, but at the same time, if you ask me right now, I'd say that they have a 50-50 shot. They could either really improve in the next year in the rankings or kind of fall backwards even further because there's so many young, high-ceiling talents in that organization. Like watching Franklin Barreto and Mitch Ney and Rowdy Tellez and guys like that. DJ, I didn't get to see DJ Davis that day, but DJ Davis. There's a whole lot of guys like that who, if it all comes together, you know, these are guys who may go to Lansing this year. None of them really were in full season ball last year, but there's a ton of guys who could be top 100 prospects.
Right.
But if with a lot of them, there's that, okay, well, we've got to see it. And they're really kind of early enough in their careers that we haven't had a chance to see it much yet. But so that you have that. And the Phillies do have some interesting guys as well. I mean, these are two organizations, I would say that, again, they're different. The Phillies don't have a whole lot of depth. But J.P. Crawford's fascinating, watching right. him. You know, so you got guys like that. You just don't have nearly as many guys with the Phillies like that as you do with the Blue Jays. But J.P. Crawford, obviously Michael Franco, who's up, you know, with the Major League camp, Jesse Biddle, you have those guys. But what I saw, you see, there were less guys. I'll put there were less guys who were jumping out with the Phillies than there were with the Blue Jays, which I kind of expected considering the fact that the Blue Jays have so many young, high-ceiling talents.
Yeah, and you're talking about, you tweeted about Carlos Tochi. He's one of those high-ceiling talents. I will say that the one thing that the Phillies have done, I think, fairly well in recent years, I think they've created a lot of value for a lot of their international signings. You know, a guy like last year, Severino Gonzalez, is a guy who was, again, a low-ceiling thought of, low-dollar signing. They didn't invest a ton of money in him. They're usually not an organization that spends a ton of money on international guys, but it did give Carlos Tochi, you know, close to $760,000. You may have seen Luis Encarnacion or David Grion when you saw them. So there are some.
Saul Devi.
So there's some higher ceiling international guys down there. I wasn't sure what your take was maybe on the minor's skinniest man, Carlos Tochi, and then David Grion.
Well, with Carlos, talking to him, a little bit in English, a little bit in Spanish, and a little bit of help of a translator. He gained 8 pounds this offseason, which is good. Now, the bad news for Carlos is he needs to do that next offseason. He needs to do that the offseason after that. He needs to do that the offseason after that. So he's right now, you know, he's still not 170, and he's still really skinny. And he's never going to be thick. He's never probably going to be a big guy by any stretch, but everything we heard in the South Atlantic League last year was, hey, more than anything, it's not the swing mechanics are a problem that much or anything. It's just he can't impact the baseball yet. And if he can't impact the baseball, there's just not a whole lot you can do offensively. And pitchers don't really have much reason to nibble or anything like that. Great defensively, great instincts. Talked to his manager last year, probably his manager again this year, Greg Legg. And he made the point, the thing that stood out to him is here you're talking about a guy who's 17, and he remembers him throwing to the wrong base once, maybe twice all last year. He said, you just don't see that with the young guy. He understands the game. He's fascinating those ways. Like, there's a lot there to like. Could be a plus center fielder who can run. He really kind of glides. You know, all the good baseball instincts, all that. But you just want to see him get bigger and stronger. It is worth remembering he's going to play all this year, almost all this year, as an 18-year-old. So it's not something like he's still – going back to the South Atlantic League, he's still going to be one of the younger guys in that league. But he's interesting, but he also, there are some significant caveats there. And that's the part that you, with a lot of these guys, you have to remember, it's like, okay, that's why I'm really excited that we got spring training going and then we're going to have games going. It's great because when you get to the games, then we start to see some of these things. Okay, is he making that adjustment? Has that developed? And I don't know about you, but that's the part where you get to that February point where it's like, okay, we've really evaluated and analyzed and talked to as many people as we can about what happened last year.
Right.
I'm ready for new things to happen.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That we can start talking to them about what's happening this year.
Absolutely. No, that's one of the, I mean, I'm just ready for this year. I mean, we've had enough winter. It's great that college baseball season's happening, but really this week is when minor league games really start getting played on those backfields. And it's exciting to actually have some minor league and some prospect stuff going on. And JJ really is kind of revolutionary in the last couple of years, just how much spring training is on TV, how much, probably a column for next issue, but there's so many more opportunities to see minor league games, whether it's over the web. The profile is so much higher than, of course, college baseball games. I mean, it's crazy how many more college baseball games are on TV than used to be. So,
Well, what, kind of one of the things that stood out to me, kind of when you talk about that, how much more baseball there is everywhere, is that, John, you and I are both kind of, by modern standards, old. We've been watching baseball, following baseball since the 70s in some ways. So I've been going to spring training for more than 20 years now, and spring training's really changed over those 20 years. 20 years ago, spring training was still kind of a hidden gem. Teams were playing in parks that really, in many ways, were not a whole lot better than minor league parks. Really were, some cases, inferior to minor league parks. I remember at watching Expos and Braves games, and they had chain link fencing, in some places, if I remember correctly. Well, now, minor league spring training is big business. You can pay $10 to park to go to a spring training game. You can pay really big league prices to watch games that don't matter, which kind of baffles me in some ways. But the one place in spring training to me that's kind of still a hidden gem is going to the backfield.
Absolutely.
In most everywhere I've gone, it's a free. You just show up, you can, and watch the games if you want. Not a whole lot of people do, but you get to see, you've got usually two games going on side field back to back. So if you're interested in this game, then you can put, you can really just turn your head and be watching a second game at the same time. Yesterday, I'm watching Trey Ball for the Red Sox on one mound and Cody Kukoc for the Red Sox on another mound. And you could watch both of them do everything they did almost, because it worked out that they were on the mounds at different times. The half innings were flipping over at different rates. So the backfields I'll be here for a week. I don't know if I'll go to a big league game while I'm here. And if I don't, I don't think I'll be missing much.
Yeah, that is the best part to me about minor league spring training. It's kind of like instructional league, only there's more kind of at stake, which is neat. People are more, the players are more invested and they're not gassed, So I really kind of like that.
They're not gassed, and they're playing for something.
Right.
Because whether on every level, if you're a top prospect, you're obviously not playing for your job. But you are playing to try to prove, hey, you were thinking about sending me to high A. I want to show you I'm ready to go to double A. If you're more of a kind of a middling prospect, you're playing for your job. I mean, you look around and hey, 20, 30, 40, 50 guys aren't leaving here with an assignment. They're leaving here without a job. And you want to do everything in your power to make sure that you're not one of those guys. And so the minor league games are very competitive, because not because people are really caring about wins and losses, but because they're playing for jobs, or they're playing for assignments, or they're playing to, you also, hey, it's not like you don't get evaluated every day in the minor league season.
No, you've got
the whole minor league staff, you've got everyone here. So you've got a lot to impress in minor league spring training.
Yeah, there are a lot of eyes on those guys, both your own organization, mostly your own organization, but also obviously you're getting scouted by other organizations as well. And then, of course, I just love the fact that J.J. Wright, when minor league spring training is over, our friend of BA, Nick Belmonte, has a camp over in Orlando, the Gainesville, Orlando area, but I guess maybe he has it down in Fort Myers. It's like, hey, if you got cut, here's an indie ball tryout camp, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the decision that guys have to make, is that if you've got an agent, or if you're yourself, if you get cut, the first thing you're doing is okay, is there another team out there, affiliated team out there that wants me? And it happens, but the chances are very low, because everyone else is in the same roster crunch.
Right.
You're not sitting there saying, hey, we're going to cut this guy, and then we're going to cut this guy, and then we're going to find 10 guys on waivers that we really, that just got released that we're going to add to the club. That's not how teams approach it. So then you've got to make that decision. Okay, well, do I want to keep doing this? Do I want to go indie ball? Do I want to hope that if I keep it in shape that a couple of months from now, there's a scout that I know who really likes me, and maybe he can get me on with their club when they have some injuries? I was talking to a couple of farm directors already, just saying, I know that this is the worst part of your job is coming up. And they are all in a pretty much agreement. Yes, the worst part of the job is coming up, because over the next 2 weeks, a a lot of people are going to be told, sorry, the dream that you've had since you were 5, 6, 7 years old is over. And some of those guys are going to say, okay, well, it's time for me to go on and do something else with my life. And a lot of guys aren't going to be really ready to accept that that dream is over. And one or two of those guys may be right. For the majority of them, no, it is, you can keep trying to do it, but the reality of it is you're not going to be a big leaguer. The numbers of guys released as minor leaguers who end up as big leaguers is a very small list.
Right, right, no doubt. Talking to J.J. Cooper here on the Baseball America podcast. J.J., well, let's get back. I actually have a question from a reader, Chris Webb, who's a college baseball writer based in the Ohio State, in the Columbus, Ohio area. He had a question about Alex Wimmers. Wasn't sure if you'd have a chance to see Alex Wimmers in Twins camp. Not sure if you saw the former first rounder there, and if you did, how he looked or what any buzz was. But just in, I'll expand it to just in general, how the Minnesota Twins pitching look at your brief look there.
No, I didn't see Wimmers yesterday. I was seeing A-ball clubs. There, a lot of times what they do here is you know, they'll send the A-ball clubs will be at one place and the AA, AAA be at another. I don't know with that. And obviously with pitchers, it's even tougher. Like you're just really, it's the vagaries of that one day out of 5 days. So I may check with some Twin guys to try to get a little update on Wimmers, but he was not one of the guys yesterday I saw. Really, probably, if you talked about the top prospect I saw pitching-wise for the Twins yesterday, it was Hudson Boyd, who looked pretty solid. I'm still, you know, a big, thick guy, but 91, 92. And really, velocity-wise, most guys right now may not be at their true, you know, max velocity that you're going to see during the season. This was the first official spring training game for any of the guys pitching yesterday. I tweeted about this. But if you want to talk about deep, deep sleeper, and I'm not saying this guy's a top prospect or anything, but Cameron Boozer, lefty for the Twins who threw yesterday, non-drafted free agent last year out of Central Arizona Community College, was kind of a stood out to me from the standpoint of if you see non-drafted free agent, you don't expect to see stuff.
Right.
You know, that's generally the rule. And he was a lefty who was 91 to 93 with some arm side run, you know, so. It wasn't a straight fastball. It had a little bit of movement on it. He also had a solid, you know, some a changeup that wasn't terrible. It was kind of just stood out from the standpoint of, hey, you're not expecting to see much. And then, no, this guy's actually got some stuff. I don't have the full backstory on him yet, but from just asking around a little bit, so I think he may have had some injuries in college. And also, that's the name. I'll put it this way. It put it on the radar where I'm going to be kind of interested to see. I would assume he might even be going to, you know, kind of being held back in extended spring, but I'll be seeing what, you know, kind of what he does this year. And because he looked like a lefty, you know, potentially lefty reliever who was a little better than maybe you would expect.
Right. That sounds interesting. I mean, but obviously the Red Sox and the Twins have very highly regarded farm systems. Yeah. I just wasn't sure what your quick takeaway was from that quick look. Did they look like top farm systems when you saw them in that matchup?
Yeah, what stands out is that there's just a number of guys who stand out. And you're not seeing everyone; you're seeing kind of little snippets of it. A lot of the Red Sox top guys are still in big league camp: Blake Swihart, Garen Cecchini, Jackie Bradley, Alan Webster. You know, you could just go down the list. But that being said, you still are seeing at the lower levels, got to see Manuel Margot, Rafael Devers, Trey Ball. As I said, Trey Ball, Cody Kukoc both pitched. So there's still a number of guys who stand out. You know, it's good to see Margot, who if you were picking a guy who's going to rocket up prospect list in the next 2 years, he's a good guy to kind of look at because there's a lot of talent there. He's in a system that has a whole lot of talent. You know, he had a couple of rough plays at third base, yesterday. But, I'm trying to make sure I'm not flipping him with Devers. Devers had a couple of rough plays, but in workouts in the morning. But, you know, Margot actually didn't do a whole lot in the game when I watched. But watching BP, he was spraying line drives everywhere. That's a little bit bigger of a leg kick than I expected to see. He does get it down early. It's a timing mechanism clearly for him, but. You do always wonder a little bit with a guy has that kind of big a leg kick. You wonder, okay, is that something that he's going to have to change and make adjustments to down the road because It's pronounced. And when it's pronounced like that, when you face more advanced pitching, that's something they can take advantage of, because what it means is you got to get started earlier. So as pitchers are changing speeds, what kind of is the counterpoint to that is if a guy's hands work really well, even if he ends up kind of starting his timing mechanism all a little too soon, he can still use his hands to stay back and stay on the ball. Margot may be one of the guys who can do that, because you just didn't see him. You saw him with the ability to square the ball up, you know, kind of pretty consistently, especially in BP. But that was something that stood out a little bit. It's like, wow, that's a little bit more of a – I mean, it's really more of a – it's in between a kick and a step, but it's more than just your normal little step to start your swing.
Yeah, it's so unusual, JJ. Can you remember anybody, to date ourselves again, as you mentioned, 70s baseball, do you remember anybody in the 70s and 80s who did like a toe tap or the kind of – it just seemed like
yes.
It seemed like everybody – who toe tapped in the 70s?
Not toe tap, but Sarahara O.
Okay, well, how about in the Major League Baseball?
In the Major League Baseball, then I can't really think of anyone, no.
It just seems like that's a hitting mechanism that has evolved over the years. It's actually probably something we've never done a story on, but it does seem like, you know, batting stances, in the 80s, you saw a lot of guys who did the Charlie Lau, Walt Riniak. You know, nobody does that anymore. It feels like there's a lot, there's still variance, but there's not so many fewer exaggerated or unique batting stances. So I don't know if the increase in velocity has something to do with that or what. That's what I would assume.
But I also think it's an offshoot of the rise of specialized instruction and showcases and all that at a younger level. I don't think that's entirely what it comes from, but I do think for a lot of guys what it is that instead of it being something where you kind of learn to hit what feels natural to you on your own. I mean, there's the famous story about Hank Aaron, you know, how he used to swing, you know, wrong-handed. You know, he had his hands crossed over wrong and helped build up his wrist. Well, that kind of thing nowadays, you have a lot of guys who are getting specialized hitting instruction from hitting instructors at you know, age 12, 13, 14, 15. And the reality of it is that most of the time you're going to end up with a much more conventional stance, because the reality of it is that normally it for – if you don't want a cookie cutter, but overall, that's something that stands out. Scouts, when you're scouting a guy, if he has an unconventional stance, some guys are going to maybe put him down a little bit for that. You know, they're going to say, well, I don't know if that's going to work as he climbs the ladder. Now, some guys, Brian Downing is a guy I always think of who really turned himself into a prospect and into a solid major leaguer because he was willing to be so unconventional with his stance. But, and you think of a guy like Gary Sheffield or Julio Franco, you know, some guys I think with Sheffield was a guy who, to his credit, figured out his bat speed was so good that he had to do something to make himself slower.
Right.
Which I've actually had someone tell me, you know, that Sheffield told him that his point, which is not something that you would tell, a young baseball player to do, that pointing the bat at. So he had a longer path to get to his kind of his hitting position than most guys, but his bat speed was so incredible that he almost needed that, because if he didn't, he was going to be out ahead of everything.
Because yeah, I mean, the time
that his brain said fire to the time that the bat got in the hitting zone was quicker than anyone else's.
Yeah, no, Ricky Weeks had to do the same thing. Obviously not to the same effect that Sheffield did, but he did the exact, and that's why he hit the way he hit. His bat was too fast. And, you know, I think his pitch recognition is not as good as Gary Sheffield's, and that's a big part of it. But
very few are. Very few are.
Yeah, but I mean, like, but his hand speed, his bat speed, when he came out of Southern, we got those comparisons all the time. I mean, it's not like he's had a bad major league career. He just hasn't had a great major league career. He's been a good offensive player, but not a great one. And his body also has gone a little bit further south than Sheffield's ever did. JJ.
The other reason that if you said fastest bat speed in the minors right now, and it's a more conventional swing, is Javier Baez.
I'd say that he probably
has the fastest bat.
Absolutely, yeah. There's no doubt about that. JJ, one other thing that I want to touch on, I'll let you go. You're seeing the Orioles and the Rays. You already saw the Ray of them a little bit this morning, and now you're driving to the upper levels of those two farm systems. And, you know, the Rays system, you know, it's gotten – we've talked about it, I think, in the past, that there's more at the top levels there than in the bottom levels. But, you know, when you see the bottom levels of that organization, you're seeing basically a lot of the products of that quote-unquote draft bonanza from 2011 where they had 10 of the first 60 picks. You know, and that draft class hasn't gone off to a great start. You got Taylor Guerrieri with his Tommy John surgery. He's also had his drug suspensions, just like, you know, so he just checks in like every other Rays top draft pick. You know, I guess I'll set up by saying, like, from 2008 to 2011, the Rays top draft picks have all had a drug suspension or they were traded or they've already retired, like 2009 Todd Glassman. Who get the highest signing bonus. They traded him to the Diamondbacks. Now he's retired this spring. 2008, Tim Beckham's had a 50-game suspension. Now he has a severe offseason injury. 2010, Josh Saleh missed all of last year. They've already traded Drew Vettelson. 2011, Guerrieri suspension. Mikey Mantic's a little bit of an underwhelming career so far. But there's a lot of volume from that 11 draft class. I mean, what did you see anything in your brief look so far at the Rays that would change my opinion that their lower levels are really in trouble and that they really haven't drafted well for 4 or 5 years?
I'm not going to go anything on really on personal experience from today, because watching a couple of guys take BP and really out, it was a work day in many ways. So say watching PFPs isn't obviously going to change any, you know, gotcha, any minds or anything like that.
Gotcha.
But no, I do think, and we wrote it in the issue that's, I've read it for Pulse for the issue that's getting ready to go to press, that really, and we've talked about it, that the drafts are not where the Rays have kind of kept themselves in contention. What they've done, I think, as good a job as anyone at is trades. And that, if you look at the top of their top prospects right now, the vast majority of them are guys that they brought in trades. It's not guys who they brought in, you know, as draft picks. What they've done a really good job of is, hey, we need a Jake Oder, you know, we need a pitcher. Okay, well, here's Jake Odorizzi. We'll bring that guy in. You know, we need a shortstop. Here's Hawk Ju Lee. When they needed a pitcher, it was Chris Archer. You know, you could just keep going back, that guy after guy who they've managed to target. And admittedly, also, it's partly because they're willing to trade a guy, and they're really, their MO is to trade a guy a year or two before he hits free agency, because in most cases they're not going to be able to afford him. And, you know, Will Myers, there's just guy after guy who they've gone out and acquired, and they haven't missed on a whole lot of those guys. They know how to build a bullpen pretty inexpensively, and that's kind of kept them going. But this isn't a top 10 farm system like it used to be. Now,
right.
Now they draft a whole lot later than they used to, but since they started drafting later, they haven't had a whole lot of hits. If a guy, you know, to me, the guy I'm going to be, if you're picking out guys that to watch in the Rays system this year, I'm really interested. Andrew Tolles is a potentially an impact guy if he puts it all together, and I think that's a big if, but he's interesting. I'll be very interested to see Hawk Ju Lee this year. How does he respond when he makes it back from a pretty significant knee injury, especially a significant knee injury when you say the entire basis of why he could be an impact guy is based on his mobility and all. So that's obviously concerning. You know, there's a lot of things to watch for with them, but no, this isn't a system that stands out because it has a whole lot of fascinating guys, you know, up and down the farm system.
Right, yeah, and the Orioles are kind of the same way, obviously. I mean, their farm system down low. I mean, basically they had a pretty crucial draft class for them last year because they've given away their whole 2014 draft, so they really need to hope that last year's draft class, the Josh Harts and some of the younger guys in last year's draft, obviously Hunter Harvey, that some of those guys pan out, because there's not going to be a large infusion of talent coming in the 2014 draft class for Baltimore.
As you said, it'd be unconventional, but me and you just talking on the phone, you know, talking a couple of days ago, if you're the Orioles, is there not some, you know, would it be crazy to say we're going to take some amateur scouts off of this year's draft or cross checkers, and we want to evaluate the international class as well as we ever possibly could, because hey, you're going to have more. They're going to have probably as much, if not more, money to spend internationally that they're going to have in the draft.
And they absolutely which is crazy, should. But I think you do your due diligence, because one of the things with the draft, and I don't think it's not the biggest reason. The main reason you scout all spring is to draft players in June. But you do hear this a lot when teams make trades. At least I hear this a lot, where they're like, well, we like them as an amateur. You know, this is a guy mm-hmm. who had great reports on as an amateur. So you do your due diligence. But I agree with you. I do think there can be if the Orioles are creative, they take some of their resources this spring after they've done their due diligence and that they after they scout their guys. If you think you've done enough for the draft on basically your fourth to 40 rounders, because the first three rounds they basically punted on, but then you send some of those resources, and by resources I mean your scouts, to Latin America, or you send a lot of those guys to Arizona this week, like Ben's going to go see some of the top international signees, and you put your financial resources there. And I think it's unfortunate the current CBA doesn't allow them to shift financial resources, really. I guess they could blow the international caps off. I think this is acquiring baseball talent, research and development, is one of the few parts of my life, JJ, where I'm actually for free and unfettered markets.
Well, I do think that we've talked about, since this new CBA came into being, baseball is less worried. The draft and all this is not as much about competitive balance as it is limiting spending below the major league level.
Right.
And then the Players Association, understandably in some way, is complicit in that, hey, they want you to spend money in free agency. They want you to spend money that way. But if you look at it, I do think the next loophole that is going to end up getting closed is that right now you can go out there and say, you know what, we're going to spend crazy in the internationally 1 year, and we'll take the hit the next year, and then the reality is if you're the Orioles, the penalty for going way over your bonus, your signing allotment in the international, is that you can't sign anyone for more than $250,000 the next year.
Right.
Well, if you look back at the last 10 years, how many years did the Orioles spend more than $250,000 on guys internationally?
Yeah, great question.
It's not that big of a penalty for them compared to past years.
How about this, JJ? I mean, when they signed the Ofelki Peralta in the offseason for, I think it was $350,000, that was the largest bonus they've ever given to a Dominican amateur. So that was that so tells
that's,
you.
Yeah, that's no penalty for them. We can only spend what we've always spent. But that's where I do think that loophole is going to get closed, because what's going to happen is that baseball, the international draft is coming, because then what's going to happen is the penalties for that would be, instead of you can only sign guys for $250,000 or more, is we're going to take away your picks in next year's draft. International draft.
Right.
And I wouldn't be, again, I'm not going on limit and predicting that's happening. I will say, though, it's a logical offshoot if Major League Baseball decides, well, we haven't clamped down on spending internationally as much as we had hoped for.
Right.
Well, that's the next thing you do, because then it closes that door, and then you really are locked in, much like you are in the draft. But again, I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, because as we've talked about many times, baseball has created much more incentives now that if you are awful, you get significant incentives to get that will make you better than if you're just merely mediocre. Mediocre now means that you've got to hit on your draft a lot more than if you're awful. If you're awful, you're going to have your pick of the best players, and there's not really any exceptions to that now. Whereas if you're merely mediocre, if you draft really well, you can still build through the farm system, but it's going to be a lot tougher than if you've got the 1, 2, or 3 pick, where you're going to have millions more to spend in the draft than a team that picks 15th.
I agree.
By the way, if you sign free agents, you're going to lose that pick. Where right. You don't, it's the top 10.
Yep, no, I agree. I think the team feels like the more, again, the law of unintended consequences seems to constantly bite MLB on these efforts to limit signing bonuses, and I just, you know, I don't quite understand that. I think it'd be much better for major league teams if they made more mistakes in the draft for $1 million and fewer mistakes on Ryan Howard for $125 million. So the mistakes at the big league level are much bigger mistakes. JJ, we got I'll let you go in a minute, but we got a lot of Twitter questions.
Hey, I'm in the car, so I'm fine.
I know, but I got a lot to do, so I'm going to let you go after I'm going to hit you up on this quick rapid-fire Twitter questions. Got a lot of questions on Twitter at John Manuel BA, at JJCoop36 are our Twitter handles. Simon, who's at Federer Funhouse, asks, how do Alberto Torrado and Laborde look? What's the Lansing rotation going to look like? Not sure if you saw those pictures. I guess it's Jairo Laborde, JJ. Took me a minute to remember Jairo's name, which is one of my favorite names in baseball. Jairo Laborde. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's fun to say Jairo Laborde. What'd you think?
Unfortunately, didn't get to see either of them in my one-day look. I do think Lansing rotation is – I actually kind of asked Clayton McCullough, their director of instruction, about that after the games and all, and very noncommittal. It's early in spring training. I think that they don't want it to be known if they know where guys are going, because – but it's true, it's going to be very competitive. Not everyone's going to make that Lansing club that, you know, wants to, obviously. And so there are some battles there. I feel confident in saying that without any question, if you said what's going to be the most interesting club in the Blue Jays farm system this year, you know, we can't include the short season rookie league teams in this yet because we don't know what their draft's going to be. But it's going to be Lansing. You know, now, again, you talk about team, they've been hurt because they've gone out and drafted guys who haven't signed. So right. How much better could it even be than it is? But they're going to have a couple of, you know, they're going to have an extra picks because of that in this year's draft. And they do have, I think, pretty safe that Rowdy Tellez probably makes that club. I wouldn't say it's outlandish at all to think that Barreto makes it, that Mitch Ney makes it. That right there, that's an infield that's going to be worth watching.
Yeah, we had a couple questions about Rowdy Tellez and the Blue Jays. I mean, like, you did get a chance to see Tellez. Who did you see in Toronto?
I did see Tellez. Yes. Tellez played the whole game. Like, they made a point, like, Tellez played the whole game. Ney and Barreto and all played about half of it. One thing that stood out was that, and this is not, you know, apropos of nothing, but willing to get dirty. I took video. You'll see it on the site before too long. But, you know, was covered head to toe in dirt. You know, played pretty high energy. Body looked pretty good. I think that's always been a question with Rowdy, because he is a bigger first baseman. But the body looked good. You know, again, I preface this. I see a lot of baseball and all. I'm not a scout. But swing looked pretty pure. Just he looked the part. He looked like what you would expect to see, a pretty advanced lefty first baseman who seems ready. Again, it would not shock me at all. I would think that he probably is ready for low A.
And, JJ, a lot of the other questions. I'm not sure if you saw Yoel Macias in Phillies camp or Roman Quinn. I guess there are reports that Roman Quinn's running and that Yoel Macias is already back on his throwing program. Not sure if you saw either of those guys. Again, I know you had a brief look.
Of those, you know, because for one thing, my flight in on Tuesday meant I got there right in time for the game, so I didn't get to see any workouts for either of those teams. And you know, Quinn, if he's working, it's probably working in more of the, you know, pretty much the schedule here for minor league teams every day, with a few exceptions, is you show up there. You know, they're at the complex by 8:30 in the morning. They're on the field by a little after 9:15 or so. Do some, you know, some kind of workouts and all, get ready. BPs start around 10. And then they're doing a lot of the regular instruction. Like today at Rays camp. I mean, just kind of a little slice of life of what it is like for these guys. So you have on one field, you have hitters taking BP, pitchers shagging in the outfield. On another field, you have guys taking BP, but they also have a pitching machine just facing the fence behind home plate, and they got a net set up bunting there. Over on the half field, they had pitchers doing PFPs. Over kind of with the kind of the extra, you know, the extra bullpen mounds in between park fields. They have catchers who are sitting there working on blocking drills. You have, you know, they had pitchers work on throwing intentional walks. The catcher signals the intentional walk. Okay, here's how you throw it. You know, you get a lot of those details. You know, that's where the detail work comes in, is that you want to have all that set in place to do it the Rays way or the Blue Jays way or the Phillies way or take your pick. That's what you do in the morning, so that hopefully when it comes around to game time in the afternoon, you pull off, you do the things. You know, they're working on situations. Okay, fielding drills. Okay, there's bases loaded, no out. Okay, what are we going to do here? Let's work on the signs. What are you going to – all those things, that all gets worked out during spring training.
That's why backfields are so much fun, JJ. I mean, who doesn't want to watch catching drills? You know, the whole thing is actually fun though. I just love the atmosphere of the backfield, just because, like you said, it's the one thing. They aren't they're no big league prices, and there's no pretense. It's people are there to work, and you really get to see these guys gearing up for a season. And you get to see multiple guys gearing up. It's a lot of fun.
Although I will point out that the Red Sox, who can print money at this point because they've got such a fan base, they're the one place, the backfield to the Red Sox, do have a concession stand. You can get a Fenway Frank, you know, at the Red Sox minor league fields, which most of the other minor league parks I've been to, you know, the backfields at the spring training complexes, don't even think of the idea of having a concession stand. But you do in Boston. You do for the Red Sox.
Well, we want to remind everybody.
Another thing I saw yesterday with that was the other thing. So Rich Hill came in, pitched an inning of a simulated game, and then they had a Japanese pitcher. I don't even have his name yet, but a Japanese pitcher who they're kind of trying out. They wanted to see if they wanted to sign him or not. So they had him go out and do an inning of a sim game. So you truly do never know what you're going to see on the backfields. Again, I got to track down who this guy's name is, but you know, again, he was 84, 86, but kept everything low, had a split, all that. Everything you would expect kind of from a control-type Japanese pitcher. But you never know what you're going to see on the backfields from one day to another.
Yeah, that's a mystery Japanese pitcher. That's interesting. Now you've piqued my interest. Well, when you find it out, I'm sure you'll tweet it at JJCoop36. Obviously, you can look for JJ's coverage on the baseballamerica.com, and we'll have – and obviously his tweets – at JJCoop36, and JJ will podcast when you come back and review your trip to Florida. And just looking forward to the whole thing. And I'm sorry, I don't have more time.
That's one thing is where, you know, you'll be able to see a lot of these guys. Unfortunately, it's a little hard to edit and then post on a spotty hotel Wi-Fi connection. But we will have a lot of video of these guys, so you can see what they're looking like right now too.
Time to hit the library. Byron Buxton style. So for our Byron Buxton correspondent, JJ Cooper, correspondent for all things Florida spring training, I'm John Manuel. We'll be back on another part of this Baseball America podcast with Josh Norris from Arizona as we continue talking spring training here at the Baseball America podcast.